Okay. So, Don? Yeah?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that we could go through, that each one of these 16 points could have a whole teaching on it.
Yeah, I think probably we could, there's...
So I'm afraid to ask the question.
There's a lot of grist for the mill, so to speak. Yeah? What's your question?
Well, that's my question. I mean, it seems to me like we've got a list, some of which maybe I think I understand, but not for sure. You know, if you ask me to explain, you know, point eight, I don't know that I could. And is this something we should do in our later review? I mean, it's...
Well, we'll talk a little bit, we can talk about some of them now, but definitely we can review them. Sometimes you might think, well, if these are qualities of the Buddha, well, you know, I don't have, I mean, that's something the Buddha has, it's not connected with me. What's the sense of me learning those or studying those? Anyone have a feeling about that from your own practice? What do you think, Venerable? Is it worth talking about higher levels of the path that we're nowhere near yet?
Really, like for example, when you were going over the previous 16 types of compassion and bodhisattvas, we were talking about it in the car and on my carpool. We were talking about, I was saying I just felt so incredibly inspired of thinking of all the different ways you could benefit beings. Like the enumeration is not just like, oh, you benefit all sorts of beings, it's like you benefit these ones like this, and these ones like this, and these ones like this. And to me, it was just so inspiring and helpful to think, you know, at some point I'll be able to benefit beings and all these
things. Right. We can rejoice about these things, is one thing. But in terms of practice, well, first of all, I want to rejoice, first of all, that you have a carpool. I think in this hot weather, that gives me now a reason to feel compassion for all those who don't have a carpool. I didn't know such things existed. This is Southern. This is California.
I'm sorry, Petra, I should have warned you.
So... also, I think all of these different kinds of practices that you hear about, there's always something that you can apply to your own practice now. Even though you think, well, I can't practice that. I can't give my body. I can't do, you know, some of these higher practices. There's something we can do now in order, because we recognize that's something I want to be able to work toward. To achieve. I will achieve that one day. Even things that we find incredibly difficult. Right now we might not think we could give up our body or we could give up our friends or family and go off and live in the mountain or, you know, we could give up our wealth. No way we might think certain things. But in a short time we could, as our mind begins to develop, and in time we will. So to try to see within all of these factors something that we can apply in our own life, I think, is very possible. It's not, you know, unrealistic. I know I may have mentioned to you before, I remember being moved several occasions, seeing Lama Sopa Rinpoche in the early years that I knew him in the 1976, 77 at Kopan. And late at night, if I would come into Rinpoche's room in the Gompa, above the Gompa, he would have the window open, with the screen, and he have his arm there filled with mosquitoes, and he would just be giving his blood to the mosquitoes, you know, like practicing, you know, like almost like So if we can, you know, we may not be able to, we can imagine someday I should be able to accept the defeat, the harsh words that others use, the insults that they throw at me. So we have to practice to achieve that state, let alone to give your body, you have to practice. We have to be able to accept the defeat. We have to start with small defeats and so forth. And so what I'm saying is there's always a way that one can utilize these kind of teachings to inspire us in some day-to-day practice. They're not totally irrelevant and unconnected to our practice. Karen? Ms. Jones?
I got a lot out of the part she was talking about bodhisattvas, that this often got beyond me, like pacification and close pacification. I have no idea what it means.
Well, that's why we
don't know what it means. You know? So
okay, like, don't say anymore. When you start, then you get more confused. When you say, I don't, okay. And then I don't, I completely. No, just go back. And then just say, so let's look at that one. Which number is that? Number two. Okay, so what did Rinpoche said? This is so these first three, and then several units of three afterwards, we're talking about the three doors of liberation. So this is a good thing. I don't believe that in our own classes here that we talked about it this last year, but it's one of the important topics that Buddha taught throughout the Hinayana teachings and the Mahayana teachings, the three doors of liberation. Have you heard, Roberto? Well, Rinpoche said in Tantra sometimes it talks about the four doors of liberation, and sometimes in relationship to the mandala. And he did talk about this, but generally in the teachings it just talks about the three doors of liberation. Let's leave the fourth one from. Then you'll see the richness of it afterwards. They're all talking about some kind of relationship about emptiness. Let's say that in terms of phenomena that are present, the present, you know, the things right in front of you, we have a sense of the imminence of something. Its nature appears to us to be self-existent. The door of liberation to deal with that is what we call emptiness. That is to say, the realization of emptiness. When you talk about things of the future, things that you might wish for or aspire for, and you project upon them as some quality that they don't have, particularly the quality of self-existence, true existence, inherent existence. That is the state which realizes that there are no truly existent phenomena in the future, which are resultant phenomena from what can occur from the present state now. That kind of understanding, when emptiness is applied to those future kinds of things, that's called wishlessness. Because there's the less at the end is like a negative particle, right? So it's, as you know about emptiness, emptiness is what kind of phenomena? Is it a positive phenomena or a negative phenomena? It's got to be positive because it's good, right? Negative phenomena. You don't want negative phenomena. No, it's a negative phenomena. Because negative is not bad here. It's just like, you know, negative can be good. No, I'm joking. Negative phenomena here means a phenomena that doesn't appear to the mind. It appears to the mind via negating something, right? So emptiness is that kind of phenomena. It negates something. So these other two, wishlessness and signlessness, are also negative phenomena. They are also emptiness as applied to one or the other, past or future phenomena. Wishlessness, what do you wish for? The past? Yeah, there are some people wish for the past. But wishlessness is talking about recognizing the emptiness of the future, future events, things that could be wished for. Signlessness is talking about recognizing the emptiness of the past causal phenomena. So we talk about causes, the emptiness of causes, entities, and results. So those three doors, the emptiness of causes is called signlessness, because causes lack any signs of true existence. And the emptiness of future effects is called wishlessness. So-called, it's still really basically just emptiness. But when you try to apply it to different, these three times, and emptiness is particularly here the door of liberation when you apply it to just the entity of phenomena. Okay? So, Rinpoche...
Could you
just
run through those real quickly,
then?
Signlessness?
Did you see... I might have mentioned this to you before. Did you see Philadelphia, the Tom Hanks movie? Well, remember, was it... Who's the fellow that plays the lawyer? Denzel. I think two or three times in the movie he had this nice phrase, "Can you run that again past me like I was
a four-year-old?"
Yeah, run that by me like I was a 4-year-old.
Did you notice as the movie went longer?
Then he said 6-year-old.
Getting longer and shorter.
Oh, right. At first it was running like me. I was a 10-year-old, then it was a 6-year-old, then it was a 4-year-old, something like that. Yeah. So you have that run by you again, right?
Yeah,
like you were a 4-year-old. Okay. I don't think a 4-year-old would be able to grasp this. So the doors of liberation come many times in the sutras, the Hinayana sutras, the Mahayana sutras. So basically the Buddha was referring to that if you want to enter into into the city, not like the supernatural power, SIDDHI, but city, CITY, of liberation, if you want to achieve liberation, the door to that is realizing emptiness. And instead, he said there are three doors. So sometimes we might, solidify the past causes. Well, not just the past. There might be causes that are present now, that are present, and maybe causes that we can conceive of in the future. But the causes of phenomena can be, in many cases, refer to earlier rather than later. Effects always come after causes, right? So when the Buddha talked about the necessity to realize the emptiness of causes, that's called signlessness. The name, at first glance, you say, what does that have to do with causes, the word sign? Causes don't have signs on them. Somehow it has to do with that causes lack any signs of being truly existent. And later, when we study about emptiness, whether it be in the Heart Sutra or other times, we'll get a little understanding of what signs of true existence means. So signlessness is one of the three doors of liberation, and it means the particular application of emptiness to causes or to past events like that. Wishlessness is another door of liberation, the Buddha said. So he said, it's not as though you shouldn't, that it doesn't mean you shouldn't have wishes. You know, that's not what wishlessness means, right? It's talking about
wishlessness,
the state of being without truly existent wishes. There's nothing that can be wished for. That's kind of the meaning of it. But if you just say wishlessness, unless you have a deep familiarity with the meaning of it, it might not bring that to mind, right? That word might just sound completely not connected to anything. Wishless. What was the Buddha talking about? You should be wishless. You shouldn't have any, you know, you should just be mindless. That's not what he's talking about. This is a particular wisdom state which recognizes that all things of the future that are effects of things, first of the present or the past, they are not truly existent, and therefore there is nothing to be wished for, either to have or to avoid. You know, I wish it. I hope. What do we say? Do we say I wish it doesn't rain? We usually say hope, don't we? No. Well, but we talk about things that are, you know, when we have some control. I wish you'd clean up the kitchen. You know, I wish you'd flush the toilet after. You know, whatever. Things that you have some control over. So this is talking about recognizing the emptiness of future phenomena or effects, results. And emptiness is talking about the door of liberation of emptiness, talks about just cognizing phenomena not in the context of being causes or results, but just their entity. So when we talk about the emptiness of causes, we call that signlessness. When we talk about the emptiness of entity, we call that emptiness. When we talk about the emptiness of results, we call that wishlessness. So those are called the three doors of liberation. And as Roberto was asking, as you remember Rinpoche talking about, sometimes in the sutras, I mean in the tantras, it talks about the four doors of liberation. Like in a mandala, sort of the four entrances of the mandala have symbolic significance as indicating or symbolizing the four doors of liberation. So there, the first three are the same: emptiness, you know, signlessness, wishlessness, and the fourth door is the emptiness of activities, I think.
Non-composition.
Yeah. So, composition, when we talk about, you know, of the 12 links, when we say not, emptiness means the same thing as non-inherent existence of, right? If something is empty, it means it's empty of being truly existent. It means it's not inherently existent or not truly existent. So that part's the same. When we talk about the 12 links, what's the first link? Do you know? You know, but you probably forgot what they are. There are 12. Yes. The second link? What comes as a result of ignorance being present is a condition to give rise to? And the 12 links. What's the second link? Sometimes we simply say action, but it actually says compositional actions. So this is in regard to what Karen is saying, or the translator said composition or something, because actions are composed, or they're created. Okay, so that's referring to actions or like that. So these, the first of these different 16, the first three are talking about, they're indicating compassions in terms of three of these three doors of liberation. The first three are related to the three doors of liberation. The first one refers to non-inherently existent causes. Okay, that is, maybe rootless is good, because if, you know, what, in a sense, causes are like the root of things, right? You follow? Also here it says rootless and without abode, or how did Vula translate that? Non-abiding, okay? Rootless, non-abiding. So this is referring to non-inherent existent causes, the emptiness of causes. Then the second one is referring to the, it says pacified and thoroughly pacified, or how did she translate it? Closely pacified. This is a little bit difficult to translate. In Tibetan we say Nerwa Shiva. Like, you know the qualities of the Mahayana Guru? The 10 qualities of the Mahayana Guru? Do you know what they are?
Yeah.
What are the first three?
The higher trainings of morality, concentration.
No, I mean in Maitreya's Abhisamaya Alamkara. No, Abhisamaya. Is it maybe the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara? There's some verse that talks about it. I think it says discipline. So this is talking about the higher training of Vinaya, discipline. But then it says pacified, and then it says the next one, Nirashiva. So these two come. So they come very often. It means an intensification of being pacified. Pacified then means trained in concentration, because the mind is pacified of distractions. And then it's thoroughly pacified, or how did Vola translate it? Closely, and a close doesn't work in English so well as a modifier. In the prefix in Sanskrit that the Tibetan takes, nera, sometimes means close, but in Sanskrit it has other modifying senses like intensifying. So thoroughly, I think, in some cases could be used. So that refers to, this is when I'm talking about these three things about the guru, that doesn't have to do with the meaning here. I'm just, the words come in other places. So that thorough pacification of a prospective teacher's mind, if they had these 10 qualities of Mahayana Guru, refers to their mind being thoroughly pacified through wisdom, higher training of wisdom. Pacified with
morality.
Disciplined with morality, pacified through concentration, thoroughly pacified then through wisdom. Because simply having concentration, you can be kind of peaceful, you know, the negative minds will not necessarily manifest. The seeds are still there. Now, I can't say about Pema. She may be already enlightened, but she certainly looks much more pacified than many of us, right? Because she has a lot of concentration. But if to go beyond that. To be thoroughly pacified means to have trained also in wisdom. So that, because there are some situations when the concentration may degenerate, and if you don't have wisdom, that you can become agitated again. So here, Rinpoche, just in terms of that one, he was saying, this, if I can remember correctly, pacification refers to results. So this is talking about the wishlessness, right? Which can arise depending on causes and conditions. So it's connected with wishlessness. And the third one, naturally clear light, implies emptiness. And you recall that this term clear light, Rinpoche mentioned, was used by Dharmakirti. You know who Dharmakirti was? Do you know, Sophia, who Dharmakirti was? No, he wasn't a student of Atisha. He came well before Atisha. Dharmakirti was a student either directly or somewhat after Dignaga. They were the two kings of logic, of Indian logic. And they presented kind of, on one level, they were presenting logic of the Hinayana, like the Sautrantika school, like our Pramana, the text that we studied, Lodic, is based on that, on the collected topics of the Pramana literature. We say Sema. And although they were talking about the Sautrantika system, on one level, they were also expounding about the Chittamatra. They were explaining that what was common between Sautrantika and Chittamatra, mind-only school. So Dharmakirti, in one of his texts, refers to the definition of being of mind as having a nature. Mind is having a nature of clear light. Remember Rinpoche mentioned this? Have you heard that expression before? So Rinpoche said that it has many different meanings, levels of meaning, but on an ultimate level, it can mean the ultimate nature of the mind is empty of true existence. So he said that that's kind of the implication here when it says naturally pure light. So that these first three are realizations that the Buddha has of emptiness, and that, let's see, after number 16 it says, having attained the 16 types of features of great enlightenment, or 16 types of dharmas you can call her, or qualities, having observed sentient beings who have not attained those and who have not realized the meaning of the natural state of great enlightenment, the Buddha engages in the 16 types of compassion of the conqueror of the Buddha. Okay? So the next three also were referring, the next three, and then also 7, 8, and 9 were all referring to these three doors. How about anything, any other questions that are vexing you? Well, let me ask, I'm here, I'll ask Venerable Sophia left a question here. So this is Venerable Sophia's question. Very neatly written on a computer. I thought this was your handwriting for a minute. Pardon? This one? This was the thing that we were saying, this had to be abandoned before, right? This is her question. Regarding the fourth reliance, relying on the wisdom instead of the consciousness, there seems to be two explanations of the wisdom. One refers to the sixth consciousness, the other refers to primordial awareness. If it is the first case, the question is that the sixth consciousness of ordinary beings is generally wrong. How can we rely on it? If it is the second case, that it refers to exalted wisdom or primordial awareness, the question is that ordinary beings have not unveiled the primordial awareness yet. How can we rely on it? From Sophia. So do you all know, if I would ask you what the four reliances are, what is your name in the, I forgot, Chuck? Okay, Chuck, what are the four reliances?
Refuge, repentance.
Do anyone already think he's on the right trail, or is he off on a tangent? Victoria, is he on the right trail? Right, so that's different. You're thinking maybe the four opponent forces. So Victoria's more got that stream. Now, if reminding you of that, do you remember what the four are? Not only in listening to the teachings, but generally in engaging with the Dharma.
Okay.
To rely on.
You rely on the Dharma.
Okay, so wait, let's go back. So the first problem is, in our, you know, to our ordinary life, you know, when you're in grade school or high school, the people who were most popular were always the people that had some kind of charisma, right? You know, they had a lot of friends. Maybe they later went on to do great things, but when you go back to your grade school or high school reunion, so all the kids that were like the most popular in the class, did they do well in your class, Venerable? Do you know? Did you ever go back to any reunions?
No.
Chris, what about you? I thought you said you went to one of your reunions. I know you're right. So this is just an example. This maybe not a very good example, but what I'm saying is, charisma in the world today, charisma is something that. People often take to be, you know, the reason they follow some kind of guide or teacher, right? In the Buddhist teachings, it said, do not rely on the person of the teacher. Rely on their teaching, first of all. You know. So this is talking about, as Rinpoche said, not to rely on just the attractiveness of the person or, you know, the excitement that is going on around them or their charisma and so forth, because that's not a good thing to rely on. That can lead you in wrong directions. Although to the world that seems to be a very reliable thing to depend upon, right? Rely on their teaching. So listen to what they're saying. Almost close your eyes, you know. Then, of what they say, don't rely on the words, but rely on the meaning. So the significance there is, don't rely on the beauty of the words, you know, she speaks so well. I was going to say he, but in deference to Oma, I'm going to try to use the female pronoun more often. No, you mentioned you thought that book was so good because there was some example of it always said she.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I never, yeah. So I'm not picking on you, I'm trying to make you.
I apologize, there was in here the Bodhisattva, whenever they talked about a Bodhisattva, they always talked about the she. And I just love that.
Yeah, that's why I said she right then. So,
thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I assure you. So there are different ways that you can get into problem by relying on the words and not the meaning. That is to say, the words can sound sweet, just, you know, the euphony, you know, just like it's just beauty to your ears, you know, or the slickness of the speech, or it may sound superficially that it goes along with your way of thinking. So someone say, "Oh, don't worry, go out, eat, drink, and be merry." What's the last line? Tomorrow.
Tomorrow you may be radioactive.
Right. What's the original? Eat, drink, and be merry. Who's the scholar here?
For tomorrow we die.
For tomorrow we die. So I mean, it sounds like good advice, right? So it means a superficial understanding also. It doesn't mean only the sweetness of the words. But delve into the meaning of what is of the teacher's words, not just whether it's pleasant and so forth. So not on the charisma, not on just whether things sound nice either to the ear, the euphony, the poetry, or the superficial kind of acceptance that your mind finds in something, but seek out what is the meaning. Then, in terms of the meaning, don't depend upon that which is subject to interpretation, but depend upon the definitive meaning. Because sometimes, just in our everyday life, we may have to say things to our children or our friends or even with wisdom, out of skillful means, we may have to say things that are temporarily helping them but are not ultimately to be abided by. So it said, when you're practicing further, don't rely ultimately on the interpretative, rely on that which is definitive, the teachings. And then how, the fourth reliance that Venerable Sophia was questioning here that came up the other day was then, how do you rely on that? Do you rely on it with an ordinary mind or a special certain kind of mind? So sometimes I have heard in the past, sometimes it is possibly mistranslated or possibly a variant of this is, don't rely on ordinary mind, but rely on the meditative absorption. You know what meditative absorption means? I think Vola might have. Meditative absorption, when we talk about the path, doesn't necessarily mean just that. It means, it can mean that. Usually when we talk about, she said a union of tranquil abiding and penetrative insight. So what we say, calm mind with the ability to analyze within it, sort of very clear wisdom mind. So it's sometimes it's phrased that way, but in the class it was phrased, don't rely on, do you remember? Ordinary, how to say, relying on wisdom instead of consciousness. It's don't rely on consciousness, rely on wisdom was one translation. But then Lama Sopa Rinpoche interjected in the class and said that another way of saying it or an addition or a correction was that don't rely on ordinary consciousness, rely on mental consciousness. So there are different interpretations. I'm not sure exactly what the text that Rinpoche was reading in the interpretation of the four reliances. On one level, both of them make sense, because all of the, even if it's a typographical difference or if the lamas use different words, they all can have deep meaning. On one level, when we talk about don't rely on just what your ultimate, for your ultimate knowledge, don't rely on just what the senses, the data of the senses, but rely on that which you're able to analyze with your mental consciousness. When we talk about His Holiness, often mentions in the teachings that the Buddhist view of our plight in cyclic existence is one that our pleasure, our satisfaction of the senses is very superficial and transient. The real pleasure that you should be able to rely on, and even now, should be more mental pleasure. And that's oftentimes people do recognize that, isn't it? There's something longer lasting about mental pleasure, satisfaction, a sense of having done right, honesty, and so forth. There's a certain greater satisfaction that's developed than some transitory pleasure of the senses. So maybe there are many reasons why that kind of interpretation is used. But it can also refer, because I asked Vola about this after the class, and she seemed to think the way that she had interpreted it, Rinpoche's statement, was also correct. was not to rely on ordinary consciousness, but a wisdom consciousness. There may have been some other modifying particles on that sentence. It may have been a wisdom consciousness analyzing the ultimate or something like that. So this is the fourth reliance is basically talking about how to get down to the nitty gritty. You know, the subject matter was determined in the third reliance. Don't rely on interpretive teachings. Rely on that which is definitive, your instructions. And then how should you rely on that? You should rely on it with a mental consciousness, a wisdom consciousness, single-pointed concentration, and eventually direct realization. Sometimes the fourth reliance is also another way that I've seen it presented. Don't rely on conceptual mind. Rely on direct perception, not of the senses, meaning with your mind. So if you realize emptiness, don't, you know, you realize the definitive meaning of the Buddhist teaching, emptiness. Don't be satisfied with understanding that conceptually. Don't rely on that principally. Rely on eventually direct realization of that. So perhaps at a future time, having discussed this now, if there's ever a situation to clarify with a great scholar like Rinpoche, what exactly is the fourth reliance? Is it talking about just mental consciousness or wisdom or direct realization? You know, which of them is it actually talking about? Maybe talking about all in different versions of it. Someone have a question they want to? Dan, you have anything? How could Buddha, could you hear his question? There was when Rinpoche was talking about this word imprints, he was talking about the concept of being familiar with things. Like for instance, because of our familiarity this lifetime, even if we don't make a lot of progress, if we leave some kind of familiarity in our mind, even when we leave this body and this gross mind disappears, some remnant of that continues on, an imprint of that familiarity continues on, and in the future life we will be more susceptible to practicing those positive things. Rather than getting familiar with cruelty and, you know, ego, to get familiar with cherishing others and to get familiar with drawing back and being cool with wisdom, you know, wisdom and method, the most important things to familiarize with. The tradition of recognizing incarnate lamas in Tibet, the tulkus or rinpoches, really basically what it means is individuals who have familiarized their mind to such a degree in the past over a succession of lives that they are much more reliable guides, even if at a certain point when you're their peer, when you're growing up with them, they might seem, well, they don't know any more than me, we're in the same class, or, you know. They have these imprints in their mind from the past to be able to act in a much more authentic way. And understanding that, thinking, even if I don't make great progress this lifetime, I'm going to use this perfect human rebirth to leave imprints in my future lives, you know, to be a better person. So I think that's the context of what Rinpoche was talking about there. I don't believe it was talking about so much this philosophical discussion about imprints of knowledge obscurations and so forth. I may be wrong. There may have been some other connection, but it was mainly a general discussion about that.
Also, on the same topic then, you also talked about the negative imprint, which I think, and how they're much harder to get rid of, and that one should, you know, do them gradually, not worry about getting rid of all of them all at once. It would take a lifetime for the negative influence.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember that. Did he say that?
He didn't say in those words, but...
That's how, yeah, that sounds... Okay, yeah. That's not a good way. Yeah, that sounds... Okay, you may have said that. I frankly don't remember the emphasis on that. But indeed, if we have certain tendency to act in various ways, to have faults in our, you know, in our lives, to act in ways that we later regret, or over time we begin to recognize as not skillful, to recognize that this has come about because of imprints of the past. It doesn't arise, this is just who I am. Excuse me, I'm an angry person. No. That's not, you know, this lifetime, the manifestation of that is because of familiarity with that in previous lifetimes. Or, I'm just a lazy person. Or someone telling you, you're just lazy. No, you're not inherently lazy. This is something that is arisen because of causes and conditions. So this can be, I don't remember him cautioning that you don't worry about it, and it'll take a long time and so forth, but maybe that's one way of understanding it. No, I'm just teasing.
The note I wrote down was imprints are hard to remove because they are the familiarity, and that they need to be removed gradually.
Right, and the same way that we, you know, clean the dishes or the pots that have been encrusted with lots of stuff, you can't get out the deepest stains immediately. You may be able to, you know, if we get Don and some inventors together, we may make some new machine that just cleans it instantly, you know, with a laser or something, right? The whole pot. But generally what you have to do is I used to clean the pots maybe at my grandpa's when we had Thanksgiving dinner. So first you had to do the pot duty. So first you get in to the pots with your hands and you took out all the gunk, the potatoes that are stuck to the side. Then, only when you did that, you could get in with some kind of that green squidgy thing, you know. And even it was getting clogged up at first because you didn't get everything with your finger. At first, just putting water wasn't helping that much. I mean, it would soften it up, but it didn't. Then later, once you got that out, you could use maybe some that Comet or what do they call now, you know, some kind of abrasive stuff. Once the gunk was off, if you put that powder on at first, it's not really... it's not getting rid of the deepest stains, right? Then finally you can use pure water. You rinse it out several times, clean. So that, I think, is the sense of gradual was referring to. We can't have expectation to make instantaneous realization. The Dharma transmitting to the West, sometimes I have a feeling there may be in some people's minds are kind of American... Western in general, instant expectation, you know, like instant coffee, instant enlightenment. And although it's possible when you have the imprints of familiarity, it is possible in one lifetime to achieve enlightenment through the practice of Tantra. That's not just anyone, you know. It depends on a person already having imprints in their mind and practice from past lives. So we can be thinking like that. I'm preparing now to achieve enlightenment quickly, even if I, you know, if you have a great wish to practice Tantra like that.
Well, it sounds like you're saying get rid of the imprints, you have to become unfamiliar with the state of mind, but your awareness is growing. It's the words that I don't understand. That's familiar, that being aware of something.
Familiarity means no. Familiarity leaves an imprint in the mind. That is, doing something again and again leaves a deep kind of, like say for instance, if we roll up the paper, this example that I remember Geshe Nawandarge used to use. He must have had some kind of insight into this. You know, you roll up the paper and then you try to lay it flat. You know, the more it's been rolled up, the more it gets familiar with being rolled. Our mind is like that. the more you leave an imprint, a sort of a deformation of it, that it's harder to lay flat again, right? I mean, you can eventually. Okay, yeah, that's the whole thing, isn't it? Stand on your head. Leave it to Roberto to see through right to the crux of the problem. Thanks, Roberto. In terms of familiarity, one of the main problems, I mentioned this before, one of the main problems when we create negative actions, the main suffering is not so much the ripening of that on ourself in terms of the experiences and so forth, suffering or being hurt or being abused. That seems bad enough. But from a Dharma point of view, the worst thing is the continuity, the habit. Because of that familiarity, the habit energy of doing it again. That's what keeps us in samsara. If we didn't have that karmic result due to the familiarity with negative things, we would have, maybe we created negative actions, and then when they ripened on us, they'd all be gone. And we could easily ascend the path. But the familiarity with things is... Familiarity with something is both the cause of the imprints and the result of it. That is, in a future lifetime, children, as a result of imprints, they're very... In a sense, they're kind of familiar with anger. They get familiar with anger very quickly because of that imprint. Some children delight in, His Holiness says, in hitting the ants and insects on the sidewalk with a stone or a hammer or something, and other people just see anything being hurt and they're sad. They want everyone to be happy. So that's kind of due to imprints in past lives. The imprints are caused by the familiarity, and then later when they ripen, they cause us to exhibit that familiarity as though we've been familiar with it from the past. I'll just ask one last thing before we stop. What are the four seals? Mr. Barry. No, you're not allowed to look. What are the four seals? No, those are just called the four doors of emptiness, right? Or let's say the four seals of emptiness? I haven't heard of that. We talked about four doors of liberation, but the four doors of liberation, this is the four seals. Yeah, these are called the four seals. They're called seals. How do you spell seal? Same as the animal? Okay, so it's not talking about four different kinds of seals. It's talking about... The four factors which attest that something is a Buddhist doctrine, so that you can get certified. Yes, this is Buddhist doctrine if it has these four characteristics. If it teaches about them or doesn't contradict them. Certainly you could say if something contradicts these four seals, any of them, it can't be considered an authentic Buddhist doctrine. And then you could debate about, because there's some variant Buddhist schools that might hold some. So what are those four seals? No, don't look down there. Quickly.
Suffering. All phenomena are suffering.
Okay, so is that right? All phenomena are suffering. We're going to be a little tough on him, because he's a good student. All phenomena are suffering?
Taminated.
What is taminated phenomena? Contaminated phenomena. Oh, you said, okay. California... I thought it was like refrigerator and library and sandwich and stuff like that. Okay, so all taminated or contaminated phenomena are suffering. Why does he say that? Are all phenomena suffering?
No.
So Buddha's experience of his own body and mind is not suffering. They are uncontaminated. So sometimes... I've seen in some presentations, especially in the Hinayana school, maybe people being very loose, because it's not the general presentation. They say all phenomena are sufferings, but it's all contaminated phenomena. Then? Very good. All compounded phenomena are impermanent. What is not impermanent?
Not
some people say everything is impermanent. Everything's suffering, everything's impermanent. What's the sense of attaining nirvana then, right? Nirvana itself is not impermanent, isn't it? And nirvana is permanent. So all compounded phenomena are impermanent. Then? Compounded means compounded from causes and conditions, brought about by causes and conditions. So if something is not brought about or compounded or composited by causes and conditions, it is something which continues to exist moment by moment in the same state. It is permanent. Then the third seal?
All dharmas are selfless.
All phenomena or dharmas are selfless, sometimes said also empty, okay? Or sometimes it says selfless, sometimes it says empty. And the fourth seal? So improper dharmas are not selfless. Is that what you're saying? So like bad behavior is not empty. It truly exists. That's right. So it's actually all phenomena, not just all proper phenomena. So the first one was limited to compounded, what to say? The first one was what? All phenomena are impermanent. All compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are suffering. All phenomena are selfless and empty. And the fourth?
Nirvana
is the actual peace, pacification. That's where you could find the only thing that, you know, nothing in cyclic existence gives real satisfaction. His Holiness, I mentioned before, I think, His Holiness in one of these conferences for teachers that's going to be taking place down. I think you're going to that one in New York. His Holiness mentioned a couple years ago when some people were kind of asking about, oh, isn't it good at the centers to have more, you know, we can have like massage classes. Not saying you shouldn't. Or we can have a more, what do you call it, these groups, dynamic groups where you talk about your problems and all sorts of things, and maybe sex therapy and dance and different things like this. His Holiness was kind of looking a bit bored, you know, a little bit. And someone said, His Holiness, don't you think this is a good idea? And His Holiness says, well, actually, thinking in this way, there's a danger to really lose the special flavor of Buddhism. Buddhism, the main thrust of Lord Buddha's teachings was not how to make your samsara better. It was how to get out of samsara. Of course, he did teach indirectly how to make your samsara better, because you need a continuity of births, you need comfort, you need resources to help others. But that's not the main aim. The main aim is to get out of samsara. If you put your main aim on how to make everything comfortable and, you know, have more pleasure, and, you know, you're missing it.
Talking about the mature series versus the immature.
Oh yeah, good.
The outer and the inner.
Yeah, we did. We talked about that before. The four ways in which there is maturation. Talking about inner and outer. The person, like the example of the mango. Mango can look really beautiful outside, like the charisma, but inside, it could be unripened, you know, like a very bad quality and not really cultivated. On the other hand, it could. Let's start from the very best situation: ripe outside and inside. The person looks calm and beautiful. To me, Kirti Senchar Rinpoche is just so delightful. It's like to see his smiling face and everything. It's just. There's a person who looks externally ripened, calm, happy, you know, loving, inside also. The worst state is being unripened both outside and inside. Some hardened criminal who looks, acts malicious outside and inside also, their mind is a mess, you know. So in between you can have a situation, which of the two is better of the two remaining ones to be ripened outside but not ripened inside, or to be ripened inside but not ripened outside? Which would be, what would you put closest to the best state?
Ripened outside.
Ripened outside and not ripened inside. So someone who looks flashy. Oh, okay. It's kind of like moda, you know. In Italy, they always talk about moda. It's kind of, everything is surface, you know, this, you know. What do they call it? Fashion. You know? Just the... Is that what they call it in Italian?
La moda.
La moda. La moda. Okay. This is the Mexican presentation. This is, I'm thinking of the Italian. They also...
Mexican is not equivalent to
Machismo. Okay. I'm working on that. Okay. So thank you, gang. I felt incredibly fortunate to be with all of you and with Rinpoche this last couple of days, and hopefully we'll have a chance in Vajrapani Institute to hear, if some of you might have a chance to hear Rinpoche's teachings there. So let's dedicate the merit that we've created leisurely. And as our lamas often say, just even when you're beginning to dedicate, to first rejoice, think about the merit that we created and rejoice about that. To think how wonderful it was, I had a chance to hear these teachings. At moments, I had moments of lucidity, and maybe even some positive minds arose due to the enlightened activity of the Buddha, our receptivity in our mind, the closeness with the teachings, created roots of virtue, familiarity, that will ripen in the future, some resource. And as Rinpoche said, dedication is a variant of prayer. It's a kind of prayer in which you don't just think, may something happen in the future, not simply that, but you think, due to this energy, which will have a causal effect, may that happen in the future. May this karma ripen in a way that not simply experienced once, like a annual tree, annual flower, or a plantain tree, or something that is experienced once and then is gone. But whatever way this karma ripens, in the first level, may it become the cause of other practices. May I, due to that familiarity, when I achieve wealth in the future, may I be familiar with giving it, being generous. If I achieve some notoriety, some high status, instead of it being the cause of pride, as is often the case, may I use that to influence people positively. In whatever way the karma ripens, pleasure of the senses, whatever, may it become a cause of my continued spiritual practice. May I benefit sentient beings along the path due to this merit. And may this merit eventually, as I see the continuity, lead to my achievement of enlightenment, awakening, purifying my Buddha potential, developing all of the positive qualities of enlightenment, great compassion of the bodhisattvas, even the compassions of the enlightened mind that senses sentient beings are suffering in so many ways by not realizing the ultimate nature of phenomena. Due to this merit, may it actually bring that result in the future. And as Lama Sopa Rinpoche has mentioned recently also, to have this very expansive mind, very extensive mind, not being satisfied with just some small goals, but sort of just letting your mind expand and think, possible, I can, I will achieve enlightenment. I will overcome my selfishness, my petty mind, my laziness, my anger, my addiction, so to speak, for the welfare of others, mm-hmm. for the welfare of all sentient beings. And then seal that dedication, that conventional action of wishing that these merits ripen in those ways. Seal that in the three spheres of emptiness, the emptiness of the three spheres. Here it's not talking about the three doors of emptiness, it's talking about the emptiness of the karma, the emptiness, well, in a sense, related, the emptiness of the karma we've created, the emptiness of the result that we hope it ripens in, and the emptiness of the activity now of dedicating.